Hello and welcome to the Counting the Earth podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Alice Hope.
And I'm Sue Nelson. Throughout this podcast, we explore the environment and the natural world, but always through the lens of one number.
And today's number is 79, and that is the number of years that researchers have been keeping a close eye on Windermere. It's one of the longest running lake monitoring projects in the whole world. And this means we've got a treasure trove of data revealing how the lake has changed in almost eight decades.
Windermere is England's largest lake, stretching across around 18 kilometres or over 11 miles of beautiful countryside in Cumbria. And if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you'll know that so far, most of our location reports have been done in the rain. And this one is no exception.
Of course, the Lake District is equally famous for its rolling hills as well as its lakes, and you cannot get all that beautiful greenery and enjoy it without all that water.
So enjoy the soothing sounds of raindrops as we join two field workers and two freshwater ecologists, Ellie Mackay and Heather Morehouse from UKCEH in Lancaster, as we're about to board the John Lund research vessel on the banks of Windermere.
Right, Alice, let's walk along the jetty to the boat. And I love the way you're holding the umbrella for me.
Yes, we can get wet, the equipment cannot.
No, exactly. Water and a microphone is not a good mix. Is it always this wet?
Yeah, we're quite used to the wet weather here, aren't we?
So yeah, you did miss the best weather at the weekend, I have to say.
That's always the way.
All the water has to come from somewhere, though.
Yeah. Okay, who's going to get in first? And what sort of equipment are you unloading?
What Ellie has in her hands at the moment is our temperature oxygen probe that we'll be lowering into the lake, getting measurements throughout the whole depth of the water column. Gareth is passing over there our sonde, which measures a range of different variables from conductivity, oxygen. We've also got our winch here that lowers down our zooplankton nets.
Now that to me looks like an old-fashioned cinema projector.
It does, yeah, with the wheel on the back.
With a handle and a wheel, like where you put the film.
So is that to capture the little microscopic animals that live in the lake?
Definitely. So it lets us lower down the net. We can then, to a specific depth, we can then pull it up and it collects, like you say, those microscopic grazers of algae and allows us to kind of track which species are occurring and when throughout the year.
And normally, how often would you be going out?
We go out once every fortnight. We visit the Windermere North Basin and South Basin, and we also monitor Esthwaite Water and Blenheim Tarn. They both feed into the North Basin and South Basin of Windermere.
Well, it looks as though we're about to set off.
We're starting to set up the equipment now. Could you talk us through what it is that we've put on the side of the boat?
These are a couple of reels, essentially. So we'll basically attach our cables for the oxygen temperature sensor and our rope reel for the zooplankton net, which we'll then drop over the side when we get to the deep point where we're doing the monitoring work. And that allows us to do a profile through the water. Each of the reels has got a counter, so the top reel will spin and there's a counter which tells you what depth you're at, so you can tell which depth you're sampling at.
All right, we've stopped moving now. Whereabouts are we?
We're now in the north basin of Windermere at the deepest point, so about 64 metres of water below us. Gareth and Glenn are just about to moor us up to our marker buoy, so we tie onto that and then we can carry out our sampling.
Now let's look at some of those measurements that you take. How have those measurements changed over time, be it
temperature or nutrients?
Through our records sort of dating back to the 1940s, we can see some big changes going on over the long term in the lake environment. So in terms of surface water temperatures, we've seen over a degree of warming between the decade of the 1950s and the 2010s in the surface waters. But we also see there's warming at the bottom of the lake. It's just at a slower rate than that at the surface. And that has a knock-on effect on the physical structure of the lake. So because when we get surface heating in the summer, that warms the surface waters, it makes them buoyant and less dense than those deeper down. That creates this thermal stratification through the water column, which inhibits mixing, and that has a really profound effect on the things that live in the lake and how that the light climate and the mixing of chemicals between the surface and the deep water. So as a result of that, we've also seen changes in the oxygen concentration at depth. So we've generally seen a decline in the oxygen over time in the deeper water. And in part, that's linked to some of the nutrient inputs and algal growth, but also linked to this kind of prolongation of the stratified period. So we've seen that stratified period's now over a month longer than it used to be back in the 1970s.
What do you mean by stratified period?
That's the time of year between when this kind of temperature gradient sets up in the spring and then it persists over the summertime, and then as the lake cools during the autumn time, that it begins to mix and becomes fully mixed again by the winter. So in Windermere, typically that will occur in December these days.
What's the consequence of there being a lower oxygen level in those deep waters?
Well, oxygen, as organisms that need oxygen to breathe well know, that it's really important for a lot of the fish species and other aquatic life in lakes that require oxygen to breathe. So it dictates where you get certain fish species. Some species are more sensitive than others. So in Windermere, we have the Arctic char, which is a rare fish species in the salmonid family. And that fish is very sensitive to warm temperatures and to low oxygen conditions. So what we've seen over time, because we've got warming at the surface and this reduction in oxygen at depth, is that the habitat that's available for that fish has become squeezed. So there's less volume of the lake that's available to that fish to survive in, really.
You mentioned about nutrient levels there, and we know that one of the nutrients that flows into the lake is phosphorus. So what's happened with the phosphorus levels in the lake over time?
When we look at our long-term data, we can see that back when the records were first started back in the 40s and 50s, the phosphorus levels were very low in the lake. And after that time, they started to increase, particularly in the south basin of the lake, to much, much higher levels. And those levels actually peaked back in the 1980s and early 1990s and have since dropped again. So there's been a reduction in the phosphorus concentrations since the kind of the 1980s, 1990s, but the levels now are still slightly elevated compared to what they were on the really long-term timescale that we have with our data.
And where does this come from, and how would we know, you know, to a sort of layperson's eye, whether a lake has a lot of phosphorus in it or not?
Well, you can't really see phosphorus in the water. The real indicator of there being a lot of nutrients in waters like Windermere is the colour when there's algae growing. So phosphorus is a plant nutrient, and algae are effectively like microscopic plants which grow in the water. So as you get more phosphorus, particularly in these kind of lakes, that's the real determining factor in how much algae can grow here. So if the lake's bright green, that's an indication that there's a phosphorus input into the lake. But equally, these kind of algal blooms also only occur when we've got the other conditions that are right. So we've got the right kind of temperatures and the right kind of light climate conditions. So we're talking about that stratified period. That's the optimum time for allowing algae to grow and do well. And even in a very pristine lake, you'd expect some kind of natural input of phosphorus just through rock weathering. So there'd be a natural background, very low input of phosphorus into a freshwater system. But what we see where we have places that have increasing human impacts is that amount of phosphorus will increase substantially, because phosphorus is found in human and animal wastes, it's found in detergents, and those different sources of phosphorus will come into the lake via sewage, via agricultural runoff, and even to a small extent via atmospheric deposition through rainfalls. There are these variety of sources of that phosphorus that get into the lake, and that will promote algal growth.
What are the consequences of these algal blooms, and is it dangerous? Is it something we should worry about?
It's first of all important to know that algae is the basis of the lake food chain. In many lakes, blooms have probably always occurred at certain times when conditions have been optimum. But algal blooms, as we think of them, can be problematic when they occur in quite high concentrations. And the issues that arise come from when they respire. So when they stop photosynthesizing, they actually use up oxygen. And the same is for when they decompose as well and die. And again, this can limit the oxygen for organisms such as fish. They can also smother out other aquatic plants, for example. They can create odour and taste issues. They're problematic for treatment as well if a water body is used for water supply. And sometimes algal blooms can produce toxins as well, which can be very harmful to other organisms and even to humans.
There was a recent report that used infrared satellite data combined with mobile phone data, which linked algal blooms to tourism. Does your research show that?
So actually our long-term monitoring, we take chlorophyll A samples from the lake, and chlorophyll A is a pigment found in all algal groups. It's found in all photosynthesizers, in fact. So it gives us an idea of the total algal production. And what we've actually found is that from the 1970s up to the 1980s, we saw an increase in Windermere basins in chlorophyll A. But since the 1980s, we've actually seen a decline. And that has been in response to improved water treatment. However, we're now seeing a bit of a shift in that the North Basin, which was typically less productive than the South Basin, has now increased slightly, and both basins are having quite similar algal patterns, if you like. But in terms of the algal blooms that we're seeing along our shorelines, we don't monitor those in the same way because they're very often short-lived. They're localised, and you know, you can see for yourself, it's a huge lake. So we can't keep our eyes on the ground and really track these in the same way. And that's why UKCEH have developed the Blooming Algae app. This is a citizen science tool, and anyone with a smartphone can download. If they suspect there's a bloom in their local freshwater, they can take a photo, upload it on the app. It then gets sent to UKCEH, where it's verified by one of our in-house experts, such as Ellie or myself. And we've actually got some great records from the lake, and indeed even in Scotland, Northern Ireland, the Netherlands as well. And records like these are really invaluable. They're helping us to build up a picture of where they're occurring and when, which is really important for these quite rapidly responding events.
Ellie, Heather just mentioned that compared to the 1980s, the algal blooms have gone down, and you said earlier that the phosphorus levels have also declined from a similar period. But there's been a lot in the media and a lot of concern from the local public that the lake is dying. Is that something that your data shows?
Well, it's a bit of a tricky concept, kind of conceptualising the world dying. I'd say our data really shows the lake is changing, so it's responding to a lot of these different environmental stresses that are on the ecosystem. So we were talking about temperature increases earlier and these changes in the nutrient conditions. So the ecosystem's responding to that, and we're seeing, on the one hand, we're getting reductions relative to the 1980s in terms of nutrient concentrations and some kind of sort of lower biomass or a kind of equalisation of biomass between the basins. So the communities are changing, and what we also think might be happening is that maybe we're getting more, in response to those kind of environmental changes, changes to the community that lives in the lake. Potentially we're getting selection for species which are more suited to growing in slightly warmer water, conditions which are more stratified. And the cyanobacteria, which are essentially a bacteria species, but they're very often called blue-green algae, which is the ones that can produce toxins and tend to be of concern. One of their really key traits is that a lot of them are very buoyant, and so they'll float to the surface, and that's where we see them. And so what could be happening in the ecosystem is that actually we're getting a shift in the types of algae that are present. So because of these other changes that are going on, we could be getting more cyanobacteria within that community, which then would make them more visible to people. like we were talking about with the oxygen is declining, and that's potentially affecting the fish habitat for the Arctic char. So that's a real concern there. But equally, there's a lot of other life in the lakes. We see lots of other fish species that are probably doing just fine in the water. And then there's lots of other animals which benefit from getting food from the lake. So like the otters and the osprey and those kind of animals, which are also present around here and using that ecosystem. So it's a really tricky idea to try and conceptualise what we mean by dying. It's changing.
The lake is obviously a place of leisure because we've got our little motorboat buzzing around us like a fly behind us. But you can understand why people come here, because even in the rain with low grey cloud, you've got trees all around us, hills, it's incredibly green. So in terms of what's causing any pollution on this lake, who or what would you say are the main sources? Is it from agriculture? Is it sewage? Is it climate change?
It's a combination of factors. I guess like most things, there's not a simple answer, and every freshwater is set within the context of its catchment and what's going on there. Work done by the Environment Agency to try and apportion out the different nutrient inputs in particular into the lake provide an overview of the kind of key inputs from sewage coming in from the wastewater treatment works, but also sewage coming from the non-mains drainage network. So that's things like septic tanks or packaged treatment plants. And then in addition, there's also agricultural sources of these nutrients which will be coming into the watercourse. And then we also have these effects of climate change, artificial modification of the lake in terms of the shorelines, in terms of erosion, in terms of pollution coming in from boat users, people coming swimming. There's been quite a bit in the media around things like pet flea treatments and dogs using watercourses, not necessarily worked on in Windermere, but showing that some of these pesticides that are being used in a domestic setting will be getting into fresh waters and could potentially be having an impact. So there's a whole range of pressures that are on the lake, and then these pressures also extend back in history. I mean, we need to remember that lakes like Windermere have been visited for over 100 years for the tourist benefit, because you can see why. You know, it's a beautiful setting, and that can build up legacies of pollutant stores within the catchment and within the lake itself, which can also be contributing to what we're seeing today in terms of the water quality that we experience.
And we'll return to Heather and Ellie at the end of the podcast to hear more of their monitoring processes and how new technology is being integrated.
Now, we heard Ellie touch on the interaction of people with the lake, be it boat users or dog walkers or swimmers. Open swimming is incredibly popular. According to Sport England, around 4 million people enjoy taking a dip in lakes, lochs, rivers and seas. And that number is from a couple of years ago before the pandemic, so it's likely even higher now.
And there's been some interesting work done on the motivations and concerns of those who enjoy swimming in Windermere. Surprisingly, it's not always about the quality of the water. Taylor Butler Eldridge from the University of Exeter has done an ethnographic PhD project where he immersed himself quite literally within the swimming community.
In a nutshell, I was hanging out with Windermere for a year, specifically visiting Ray Rigg Meadow and Miller Ground 100 times between September 2022 and 2023. These are two popular designated public bathing sites. It involved immersing into these spaces and observing and reflecting on the different social interactions of others and myself at different times of the day, in different weather conditions, on my own, and with other swimmers and groups. I undertook 40 swim-along interviews across the year, recorded with a GoPro mounted to my inflatable toe float.
What was it you were trying to understand about the experience of the Windermere swimmers?
My research questioned how swimmers were negotiating their different health motivations and concerns. There's a strong narrative of outdoor swimming being positive for human health and well-being, but there's also a wave of public concern for water quality, especially at Windermere, but also nationally. So there's a significant tension there. Still, our decision to swim or not will never just be dependent on water quality. So I wanted to add that complexity and relationality to understandings of these health motivations and responses. I found that water quality concerns linger for regular swimmers, but it's often sidelined by their motivations to swim. Because no matter whether you're a triathlete or you're casually swimbling around, we each bring endure and leave with different responses and understandings.
Well, before we hear more about the various motivations of the swimmers you met, I noticed you used the word swimbling, which I've not heard before. What does swimbling mean?
Yeah, I like that word too. Yes. My understanding of swimbling is leisurely swimming breaststroke with your head up and chatting to your friends or peers.
Oh, what a brilliant description. That's absolutely perfect. Let's hear some excerpts from the interviews that you did with those swimmers, and these are voiced by actors.
Mary, I class the water as my happy place. So if I'm having a bad day, I get in the water. There's nothing like it at all. Terry, maybe that's why it appeals to groups of women. Safety in numbers. Confidence to just, you know, get your kit off and go for it.
Mike, a big element was the communal sense. I was looking for a peer group with older guys. That was something missing in my life.
Rebecca, I sit there and think, why do I do this? This is awful. This is so cold. And then I do enjoy it.
Charlie, when you have collective suffering, you forget about the pain. But sometimes when it's just you, it's hard to get in.
A real mix of thoughts there. Some anxiety about the cold, quite understandably, but a common theme about a sense of community, I think.
Yeah, it's important to note that concerns about swimming kick in before we've even left at home. Concerns do include sewage and blue-green algae, but often it's the perceptive response to the water temperature. We anticipate the cold on our skin before even dipping our toes in. It also includes our swimming ability. It's how comfortable we feel when exposing our bodies. And when immersed, the concerns are usually around negotiating the cold, alongside boat traffic, nearby swans, and what's happening also on the shoreline. There's some significantly heavy motivations to swim. I heard stories of grief, trauma, and isolation, and these spaces and communities can be a real lifeline for some. For some, busyness can hinder their experience, and there's tension between different user groups. Still, frequently in the community, I would see the rhythmic effects of slowing down and the support of peers when entering the water. And then the post-swim huddle, the tea, the cake, the shivers, the opportunity to laugh and moan, and it can bring lightness.
Funnily enough, two women I know used open water swimming as a sort of recovery process from a divorce. It made them feel alive, whereas I think I more chime with some of the things you said about being too preoccupied with the cold. But like you said, many people spoke about their views on why they were swimming, but also what they were swimming in. Pollution, quality of water and the environment in general.
Tina, I've never had anybody say I've been sick, but people might not talk about it.
John, the water company is part of the problem, but an essential part of the solution. How do we put pressure on the right people so that they do take their responsibilities seriously?
Rebecca, my swim gloves, they will have like a green tinge to them if I don't wash them straight away. So that's normally when I know, like when the water's not been great.
Clem, a healthy Windermere would have less, much less algae on it. No litter. I think there'd be a real abundance of wildlife.
Petunia, all of the rubbish from the people from the night before, that will take away what I'm trying to get from the water. Maggie, it is a worry going into the future. Climate change. Are we going to lose species? How will that affect the ecology?
Significantly, my conversations with regular swimmers would often veer towards the visual impacts of litter and plastic pollution long before talking about blue-green algae or sewage. Still, there was rarely discussion about manufacture or government regulation of plastic materials, or about the potential health impacts to human and other freshwater species. Notably, it's important to recognise that swimmers also carry a trace, including the chemicals on our skin, the microfibres or the spread of invasive non-native species from our kit. Now, regular swimmers did express biosecurity concerns, but recognise this has been clouded through much of the attention on sewage and blue-green algae.
What about bacterial concerns?
Bacteriological concerns caused by sewage or misconnections or agricultural runoff, really tricky for swimmers to pinpoint because you rarely see it when swimming at Windermere. Some called for improvements from private water companies and government regulators, and some recognised the complexities of multiple local wastewater sources. Many, though, are unaware of how warming waters through global climate change were also impacting blue-green algae concentrations and the loss of freshwater species. After heavy rainfall, some swimmers keep their head above the water. Many have seen blue-green algal blooms and avoid swimming at that time or will enter down the shoreline, but some persist. 5 out of 40 swimmers I interviewed recorded experiences of ill health, including sickness, diarrhea, and skin rashes following direct contact with blue-green algal blooms or following prolonged long-distance immersion. 35, however, confidently suggested being asymptomatic. I have also never experienced these symptoms from swimming at Windermere, but we cannot dismiss health concerns. There's still many, many questions in our changing climates.
It's interesting you mentioned about the changing climate. Our theme number for this episode is 79, and that's the number of years that Windermere has been monitored. So with that change in mind, was there a recognition among the swimmers you spoke to of the need for well-sourced data and research, or were people swayed more by the campaigners and the media coverage they see?
There was no kind of unanimous opinion. Some saw a place for all these different voices to raise awareness and demand change from those in power. But others were frustrated by campaigners and media attention, calling it sensationalism. Notably, most swimmers I spoke to were unaware of the Environment Agency's SwimFo website or the testing between May and September for E. coli and intestinal enterococci at the 4 designated public bathing sites on Windermere. Unfortunately, the Surfers Against Sewage Safer Seas and Rivers app does not include Windermere or its surrounding catchment. But some swimmers have aligned with the Big Windermere Survey, led by the Freshwater Biological Association and Lancaster University, which has enabled a catchment-wide snapshot of water and bacteriological quality. Some swimmers are going to plod on, whatever the conditions, and others will want an authoritative figure to answer, is it safe to swim in Windermere, yes or no? Which nobody can really ever answer, as these risks are so subjective, they're often felt senses. But many swimmers are also calling for investment and regulation in our multiple wastewater systems, alongside ongoing research and real-time monitoring to better inform our decisions whether to swim or not.
Taylor Butler-Eldridge from the University of Exeter, looking at the concerns and positive effects of open water swimming in Windermere. The UK has over 600 designated bathing water sites, with another 27 agreed for England this year, from Dorset and Devon to North Yorkshire. The water quality standards for these sites are based on research by the World Health Organization, which looks into the incidence of stomach upsets in bodies of water with different levels of bacteria.
Now, at the moment, only 2 types of bacteria are tested for: E. coli and intestinal enterococci, which come from either sewage or animal manure. Government environmental agencies carry out more regular tests on these sites between the middle of May and the end of September in England and Wales, and from the beginning of June to the middle of September in Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Taylor and other open water swimmers want to see changes to the monitoring of designated bathing water sites. They're calling for testing all year round, including checks for other bacteria, such as the blue-green algae we heard of before, also known as cyanobacteria, which can produce toxins that make people sick.
Although during his year of fieldwork between 2022 and 2023, he did only see 1 significant blue-green algal bloom on the lake.
Okay, let's return to the lake itself now with freshwater ecologists Ellie Mackay and Heather Morehouse for their final observations before heading back to shore. So we've got a net coming out here. Is that one of the zooplankton nets?
Yes.
It almost looks like a wizard's hat. It's sort of quite cone, sort
yes,
of conical.
Yes, it's a sorting hat. Yeah. In every sense of the word.
It is indeed, yeah. And if you look at the bottom, you can see a nice little tap almost. So once the net has been brought up, that tap is opened and we decant the zooplankton into a bottle with preservatives. Ellie's got the sample here, so you can see those little beasties swimming around.
They look like tiny poppy seeds suspended in water.
Yeah, they're probably Daphnia, also known as water fleas.
Oh, well, I won't get
Do
too
you think
close.
Yeah, there's some Daphnia and some copepods in there. Yeah.
You can see them all swimming around, and you'd never even know that they were in the lake if you didn't sort of pluck them out.
There's this whole fantastic, you know, underwater world that a lot of people don't really realise, with all these complex interactions. So the zooplankton will probably be coming out now and then be found in larger abundances because the algae will be growing. If you can believe it, we have had some sunny weather in the last few weeks.
I've just seen a big boat go past. It's got a lot of uses, hasn't it? Obviously, it's got this very complex ecosystem, but it's also widely used by humans.
That's true. There's a lot of recreation. You know, you've got the ferry, Windermere Lake cruisers. On sunny days, you see kayakers, paddleboarders. There's a big community of open water swimmers around the lake.
I learnt to sail on this lake.
I think I saw some anglers as well. So there is a very sort of large community that uses the lake.
Hold on, there's a lot of action going on at the moment. Yeah.
What Glenn's doing there is this tube collects our integrated water sample. So it's got a weight at the bottom. It's lowered down and it basically collects water from the top 7 metres of the column. That water is then decanted, which Gareth is doing now. And we use that water to test for nutrients, alkalinity. We also use some of the water for our phytoplankton counts, so we preserve it and settle it out, and then we can make microscopic slides to count the phytoplankton there. And we are also monitoring for DNA as well.
What type of DNA?
Yeah. We're really focused on those kind of microbial communities, so we're looking at eukaryotes detecting the algal species. So we're doing a bit of comparatory work between what you can see from doing a traditional technique like light microscopy and what you get from these new methods like eDNA. But in addition, we're also getting some sequences of the bacteria, so we're getting a bigger picture, and also the fungi, so getting a much bigger picture of that kind of microbial community, which is really, really important for driving a lot of the processes that go on in the lake, and the cycling of nutrients, the changes to the oxygen. They're all driven by these different communities, and so having a better understanding of those and how they change over time is something that we're trying to bring into our monitoring. So it's a relatively new aspect of what we do, but it's something that's starting to produce some really interesting results.
And I suppose that's probably happened a few times over the history of the monitoring of the lake, going for 79 years. The technology has changed a lot over that period of time. So has the methods of the monitoring changed over that period of time as well?
Yes, it's the tricky thing about long-term monitoring, because you want to keep some of the methods the same, so it's as comparable as it can be. But yeah, there'll have been changes in the temperature and oxygen sensors that we've used. The water sampling method probably hasn't really changed, and then some of
that's
the
still a bit of a pipe.
Yeah, it's still, you know, it's a really simple, tried and tested effective method. This metal disc here that's on the deck, that's called a Secchi disc. That was invented by a Mr. Secchi back in the 1800s or something. You know, that's a way of determining when the light disappears. When you lower it through the water column, you can't see it anymore. That tells you what your kind of visibility in the surface water is. And that's a really good rough indicator of what's going on in a system. If the Secchi disc disappears really near the surface, that means you've probably got a lot of algae in the water. But in addition to that, yeah, we're really interested in how we can use new techniques and new technologies to improve what we do with the monitoring. So down in the south basin of the lake, we have an automatic water quality monitoring buoy. So that's been there for over a decade now. That's basically got a weather station above it, because weather over water is a bit different to over land. So if you can measure it over the water, that's really helpful if you're trying to understand how the lake is responding to those really short changes in weather conditions, that kind of thing. And then in the water, we have the sonde that we saw earlier. So that's a multi-parameter sonde giving us measurements like conductivity and temperature, pH. It's also got a fluorescence probe to tell us about the algal concentration. So it's a different way of measuring the chlorophyll A that Heather mentioned earlier. And then we also have a temperature chain. So that goes at different depths in the water. We've got a little thermistor, which gives us the temperature. And all that data is transmitted to a data logger that sits on the buoy. And then that, via the mobile phone network, transmits back to our virtual server at Lancaster. And that gives us really, really high frequency data. So that's measuring every 4 minutes. So we can really pick up really short-term changes. So that allows us to study things around the impacts of things like storm events on the lake or rapid changes in the stratification, the way that the lake warms up and cools down in the summertime periods.
It looks like we're finished. That was incredibly quick, the sampling.
It can actually be the time on the boat getting to the sampling site that takes the longest. But, you know, we've been doing this for nearly 79 years, so we know what we're doing.
Ellie Mackay and Heather Morehouse from UKCEH in Lancaster, and the important role they're playing in long-term data monitoring on Windermere. And if you want to learn more about the lake or thousands of others, UKCEH has developed a lakes portal with University College London. Just Google UK Lakes Portal and you'll find it.
79 years of continuous monitoring is something that UKCEH is incredibly proud of. As we've seen, the range of sampling is really extensive, helping to give us a big picture of what's happening with water quality in the lake. And if you're interested in open swimming, do check out the government agency websites. Each nation's environment agency provides monitoring data and bathing water status profiles, which will give you information about a range of issues from litter to blue-green algae. There's also an interactive map of sewage discharges on the Rivers Trust website, which allows swimmers to steer clear of areas directly downstream from these discharges, especially after heavy rain.
Surfers Against Sewage also have a Safer Seas and Rivers service app for real-time water quality alerts covering over 350 beaches in the UK, but not Windermere just yet. We heard about the positive effects open swimming can have on well-being, so do give it some thought. Thank you for listening, and please do join us next time on Counting the Earth, where we take another look at nature through numbers.